think we're just about ready to start now. We appreciate everybody coming in again today. Edward J. Huggett, Jr., O.D., Chief of Low Vision Services, St. Luke's Cataract and Laser Institute in Tarpon Springs, Florida. He has actually started three low vision clinics in his career, and this is where he is right now. He started also the James Haley VAMC and the Morton Plant Hospital, and now St. Luke's Cataract and Laser Institute, a very ambitious young man and an excellent doctor. He was raised in Florida. He got his BA in biology from University of South Florida in 1981. He taught special education for 5 years at the middle and high school levels and got his Doctor of Optometry degree from University of Houston College of Optometry in 1990. Ed, thank you for coming today.
Dan, thank you so much, and every participant of the International MD Support Group, I really appreciate each person here today, and I really wish I could just come into your offices and clinics and just be a part of and actually personally there with you. But what I wanted to do today, it's kind of a little different than what we've been doing. What we've been doing is really going over some real specific problems with vision and eyes and eye conditions, but you know, one of the things I really enjoy doing is just fun facts and finding out some basic information about the eyes. And I came up with a little presentation that I call I Didn't Know That. And it's basically a journey through the human eye. I think everybody will really enjoy it today. Just sit back and listen. And if you want to look at the slides, certainly feel free to do that. I'll be describing them as we go through here. But the main thing is just in your mind's eye, picture some of the things that I'm going to be talking about today. And then we'll have a short question and answer period after that. But today what I want to do is I want to take us on a tour. You know, for those of you who have been with us here at the International MD Support Group before today, we've had presentations on macular degeneration in all its forms, on new developments, on projected treatments, and past treatments. But we have never looked at the basic building blocks of what we are discussing. We have never, you know, we could talk about a lot of things, but we could talk about the retina. But if we talk about the retina, then our desire is to talk about the parts of the retina, the rods and cones. And we could talk about the blocks, building blocks of the rods and cones, but then we want to talk about the pigments and the parts of the rods and cones and photons and so on. So let us turn back to a point where we are actually looking at the foundations of not only the retina, but the eye itself. Let us not stop there. Let's go back to the basics of life itself and start the journey there, because it is from here, or actually there, that we can gain a greater appreciation for where we have been with vision health, where we are, and where we are going. And ultimately, my wish is for us to see the gift of vision in all its wonder. My only hope today is that each of you will hear at least one thing that will make your sense of wonder quicken, give your appreciation of life a new spark. It is to this end that I present this to you. To start the basic building blocks of matter, as you may remember from grade school, is the atom. It is now estimated that there are more atoms in your body, just your body alone, than there are stars in the known universe. The next step is to look at DNA. Let us look at the code of life, DNA, the blueprints of your body, molecules which are basic chemicals, no life in themselves, but arranged in a specific order, and have qualities that with a superficial glance appear magical. DNA, your DNA, half from your father, half from your mother, brought together to make the unique you that you are. DNA is the program that tells your cells how to make proteins, how to grow, and how to live. It is a message, a language, just as the languages that you write and communicate with, but is written with the ink of molecules on the paper of your cells. Your fingernails, or digestive enzymes, or photopigments for vision, the code is quite simple and yet very exquisite. You have seen diagrams of it, and here I have a diagram of DNA. It is like a long ladder twisted into a spiral. The four molecules make up the ladder rungs. DNA is a message. It is information. To give you an idea how much information is contained in DNA, take, for example, the single-cell organism, E. coli, a much-studied cell. The amount of information in the DNA of E. coli is vast. In fact, it is greater than the information contained in all the books in any of the world's largest libraries. This apparently simple structure betrays an immense complexity. But if you were to take out the entire DNA from a single cell and stretch it out, it would be over 5 feet long. That's 1.5 meters. If you were to take the single cell DNA and compress it down, it would be tinier than a speck of invisible dust. Yes, one strand is only 50 trillionths of an inch wide. A strand of DNA stretched from you to the sun would weigh a slight 1/50th of an ounce. If you took the entire DNA from all the cells of your body and squeezed it together, it would fit inside an ice cube. But if you took the same DNA from all the cells and stretched it out from end to end, it would reach 10 billion miles. That's over 16 billion kilometers at a minimum, and that's just your body and not anyone else's. That is a distance of over 41,000 times the distance from the Earth to the Moon. When DNA replicates, there's remarkable accuracy, making only one error in a billion toppy steps. And when an error occurs, DNA has its own spell checker, an enzyme that examines the newly copied DNA for errors. When an error is found, that segment is replaced. DNA, your DNA, will determine not only your humanness, but also your eye color, the amount of curl in your hair, the sound of your laughter, and likely much of your personality. So with only a fraction of the respect due DNA, we must leave this spot and move up to a larger block of the whole, the cell. A quote from a colleague of mine, James P. Gills, M.D. He says, "The living cell is, in itself, the basic brick of life's awesome construction. It is far more complex than any large modern city that we are familiar with, or any celestial galaxy that we gaze upon. From one cell at conception, through a miraculous concert of division and specialization, there results in 60 trillion cells that make up your body. Unimaginably complex, the fertilized egg will begin to divide into a colossal 100 trillion cells, and all of these cells, by the time you were born, will have differentiated into 200 varieties with specialized, prescribed jobs to faithfully attend to. Liver cells, kidney cells, and brain cells. Everything that makes us what we are. Truly, e pluribus unum, out of many one. They must live in community with their surrounding neighbors, flawlessly doing their own specialized part of the whole. Our cells are absorbed and replaced at a rate of a trillion a day. That is approximately equivalent to renovating a house the size of Texas by continually tearing down and rebuilding 100 million rooms per second. At that rate, skin is entirely replaced every 2 weeks, and you have an entirely new skeleton every 7 years. What we're looking at on the slide here is actually just part of a cell, and that is the actual membrane, the part on the outside of the cell that is visible. And not only just to show you that the cell is just amazingly complex, but they all work together in perfect unity. Each cell is surrounded by a membrane thinner than a spider's web that must function precisely, or the cell will die. Each cell generates its own electric field, which at times is larger than an electric field near a high-voltage power line. Each cell contains specialized energy factories called biofires that use a conductor, also known as ATP. Every cell contains hundreds of these miniature ATP motors embedded in the surface of a structure called a mitochondria, and each is 200,000 times smaller than a pinhead. Cells do not stockpile ATP energy, but instead make it as it's needed from food consumed. Active people can produce their body weight in ATP every day. Each cell has its own internal clock, switching on and off in cycles from 2 to 26 hours, never varying, just doing its assigned job. Let's talk about organs for a short while. How about your lungs? We breathe oxygen to fuel the cells. Your ear has a million moving parts that vibrate up to 20,000 times per second. Your heart is a fabulous organ, tireless, that will squeeze life, 60 million gallons of blood in total, throughout and around your body, an average of almost 3 billion times in 75 years. There are 60,000 miles of blood vessels in an adult body. These make passage for red blood cells and their oxygen-binding molecule, hemoglobin, traveling over a distance equivalent to 2.5 times around the Earth at the equator during their relatively brief 120-day lifespan. These multitudes of microscopic cellular functions are happening continually in every cell of your body. Many of us simply take for granted this wonderful creation, the human body, the symphony that is the result of the various cells that make up organ systems working together. Let us look now at a specific organ, the eye. From the front part of the eye all the way to the back. In fact, we won't even stop there. We'll go beyond that. We'll go through the cornea, the iris, then the lens to the retina and optic nerve. When does the eye start to form? In the fetus, the eye begins its development 29 days after egg fertilization. So from the time of conception at 29 days, your eyes are already beginning to form. Through a very highly coordinated effort, waves of cells migrate to their proper spot, their home for life, to begin their occupation of vision production. Waves of cells migrate to form the cornea, the retina, the iris, each type of cell finding its own address. And on this slide, we show on the left, obviously, a sperm fertilizing an egg and the result of that on the right. Each cell has a job to do. It may be a corneal cell or a retinal rod or cone or maybe an iris pigment cell. In any event, each cell must not only develop to what it is to be, but it must be in the proper location with others like it to have a functioning eye. The cells find their own way to their home, waiting for the day of birth and a sudden flood of light into the eyes, the start of a lifetime of vision. Now let's travel back further here. Let's go to the eyelids. Where to begin? Well, let's start at the front here. Eyelids, a minor part of the eye, you say? Well, you didn't think it minor when that wink from a gal or man sent your heart racing was so minor, did you? So are eyelids important? Of course. The eyes make 100,000 separate motions each day, and the eyelids will blink over 400 million times in an average lifetime. The eyelids are very complex structures that provide a number of services. They must keep the front of the eye wiped clean, spread tears evenly over the cornea, protect the eye from projectiles, pump foreign objects to the corner of the eye so they can be removed, and help the cornea to breathe. How can it do all that? Well, when the eyes are closed and when you're in a deep sleep, your cornea is still requiring oxygen, as does all tissue to live. And if you look at the diagram, the photograph of the cornea in front of you, that's actually the clear structure that's over, it's actually a dome-like structure that's over the colored part of the eye there. And that's living tissue, and it actually needs oxygen. But you'll notice that there's no blood cells in the cornea. If there was, certainly we wouldn't be able to see through it. So it's a tissue called avascular, one of a few different avascular tissues in the body. But because it still needs oxygen, how does it obtain that? Well, there's a complex bed of capillaries on the back surface of the eyelids. When your eyes are closed, oxygen diffuses from the capillaries on the back side of your eyelids and then into the cornea next to it, directly supplying needed oxygen to this vital structure. For without oxygen, the cornea will become completely opaque. Many people do not like their eyelids. They droop. You need to blame gravity for that. They get baggy. Blame water and time for that. Due to aging, the skin loses its elasticity and hangs in folds. In kidney disease or even in lying down for a short time, there is accumulation of water in the body and water in this area. This is seen as bags under the eyes. The eyelids also have their eyelashes to keep objects out of the eyes and are also loaded with oil glands. The oil glands have openings on the lid margins near the eyeball to produce a thin oil that will spill over into the tears, forming a thin layer floating on watery tears. This will ink eyelids over the eyeball and also decrease evaporation of the tears. The oil seals in the water in the tears. Your intake of flaxseed oil can increase the quality of this lubrication, providing relief from dry eyes. Your body absorbs flaxseed oil and within a month or two transports it up to the meibomian glands in the eyelids to be expressed into the tears. Many of you have heard of a recommendation for taking flaxseed oil, and that's one of the main reasons why. Just behind the eyelids is the cornea, and here you'll see a diagram of that. That's that dome-like structure that I mentioned that's clear. In fact, the cornea is the initial light-focusing structure of the eye. Balance of corneal clarity and, therefore, sight is highly dependent upon the ability of each highly specialized corneal cell to control its own absorption of water, nutrients, and oxygen. How thick is a cornea? Only a half a millimeter thick. That's 0.02 inch thick at most. But the cornea is made up of 5 layers. But let us look at the layer on the back surface of the cornea called the endothelial cell layer. You know, it's interesting to me, and it never ceases to amaze me, that there are people, colleagues of mine, that make their whole career based on a part of the eye in terms of study and treatment. There are corneal specialists, there are retinal specialists, there are optic nerve specialists, an anterior segment specialist, and or a taste for how complex the eye is. What we see here now is we see a cross-section of the cornea, and on the top of that cross-section, which is labeled epithelium, that would be the outside of the cornea, and then through the thick main part of the cornea called the stroma, and on the back side of that, it's called the endothelium. The endothelium is a layer of cells approximately 3,500 per square millimeter for each eye. But you're born with a finite number of these cells. The cells that you're born with is the only number that you will have. They never multiply after birth. You will not grow more, even if you lose them, some due to trauma or surgery. These cells provide both a barrier to water flowing into the cornea from the cornea, front chamber of the eye. Surprisingly, these cells are able to recognize minute trauma on the surface of the cornea, such as a contact lens abrasion or scratch. They will allow increased fluid flow into the cornea, bringing with it additional nutrients to preserve the integrity of the corneal tissue. The endothelial cells are able to recognize disease and trauma at relative distances that would be equivalent to a mother in New York City responding to her child crying in San Diego. These forewarned cells then begin producing a new protective barrier, the decemase membrane, on the back surface of the cornea as a preemptive repair mechanism that prevents perforation. With such a system in place, the cornea, the whole eye, and sight may be saved. How magnificent and mysterious. The endothelial cells are nature's most geometrically stable shape. They are the shape of a hexagon. They breathe oxygen from the outside of the cornea, and with every blink, new oxygen is supplied to these cells on the inside of the cornea. The next step along our path is the curtain of the eye, the iris. You know, the iris contracts and dilates to control passage of light to the back of the eye. In fact, it also helps to focus images on the retina. The pupil is the area of the eye that is actually a hole in the iris, producing a pinhole effect. The pinhole effect provides an image correction to enhance the focusing of the image as it travels to the back of the eye and onto the retina. One pigment, melanin, produces freckles, dark skin coloration, and dark hair. Without melanin, we have blue eyes, not actually blue, but what appears to be blue. The blue color comes from the diffraction of light off the collagen fibers of the iris. And here we're looking at an actual photograph of a blue iris without melanin. Adding a small amount of melanin will produce a green eye. More melanin will produce a hazel-colored eye. Then progressively to brown, then to black. There are even rare eye colors, iris-melanin combinations that produce a lavender-appearing iris. The iris is the most data-rich structure in the body. An iris possesses 266 separately identifiable characteristics compared to the rather scant 35 displayed by the hand's fingerprint, which is currently used for identification. The iris also allows for communication between people. Studies have shown that pupil size is subconsciously evaluated when communicating with others. A small pupil sends a message that you are not friendly or not happy. A large pupil sends a message that you are open to others, friendly and satisfied. The next step along our path is to the lens. Held into a place by a scaffolding of radial fibers, it does a fine tuning of the image as it's focused into the eye. In fetal development, the eye starts forming 29 days after egg fertilization, and the lens is derived from the same tissue that forms your skin. It is not then surprising that exposure to UV light, the same light that causes darkening and wrinkling of the skin, will cause a cataract, a darkening and wrinkling of the lens. And here we see a diagram, a photograph of a lens. You'll see it's like a light cross-section. It's a cross-section through the lens with a special kind of light that eye doctors use called a slit lamp. And you'll see a kind of a white, opaque, oval shape inside the eye there, and even a little bit of a yellowing. That's an early cataract. So when you go out into the sun, you need sunblock for your eyes. You need sunglasses or even glasses with a UV filter. Remember, though, UV light is mostly invisible, so a UV filter in your glasses is also invisible. Many contact lenses now also have a UV filter in them. The lens is made up of interlocking fibers. The fibers allow for flexible movement required for focus change, such as when you are looking from far to near. There are many small hooks and sockets that hold the fibers together and allow for smooth movement of the fibers. Here we see lenses in various stages of cataract formation, but more importantly than that, something that's just fascinating to me is when you look at the microscopic of the lens, you'll actually see fibers, and on each fiber, you'll see little hooks, and then the opposing fiber will have little openings, almost little sockets, and these hooks fit right into the sockets. It allows for a very strong structure, a structure that basically won't fall apart, but is very, very flexible, and that's the structure and microscopic structure of the lens itself. The next step is the retina. The retina lines the inside of the eyeball. It is a light-sensitive tissue that images are projected onto for you to see. After the focusing accomplished by the lens, light and images pass through the jelly-like vitreous to strike the retina, which blankets the back of the eye. The retina is composed of many types of nerves. In fact, the retina's job is to first convert light energy to electrical signals. The rods and cones are the first cells directly involved in communicating information within the visual system. The rods and cones have specific jobs, rods for and peripheral vision, and cones for color and fine detail perception. And they translate light photons into electrical impulses for the brain. The retina's continuous exposure of its pictures would take a Cray supercomputer 100 years to simulate what is occurring in your eye every second. Here's a diagram starting over on the right-hand side, the outside of the retina, some cells called RPE cells. And then you'll see those kind of elongated cells. Those are called rods and cones. And above them, further in towards the eye, are glial cells or nervous cells, cells that actually transport information to the optic nerve and then to the brain. Here you'll see actually an electron micrograph. That's your eye. That's equivalent to an ability to function over a constant change of 1,000,000 to 1. In the approximately 100 million rods and cones, and through a complex chemical reaction, when light hits a pigment in a rod or cone, the pigment breaks down, and through a chain reaction, an electrical impulse will travel to the visual cortex. That's the vision part of your brain, in the back of the brain. Of these 100 million photoreceptors in each eye, 7 million per eye are cones, and most are in the macula. Each cone contains one of three color pigments that respond to differing wavelengths of light. Some cones are sensitive to blue light. Some are more sensitive to green, and some are more sensitive to red. Some with color blindness are usually not totally color blind. In fact, I've seen very, very few people in my practice over the almost 19 years, that are truly color blind. When we say someone's color blind, typically we mean color perception deficit, meaning that they see some colors, and they actually see most colors, but not with the same appearance people see them. They may have difficulty determining the difference between shades of blue and gray or oranges and reds. Studies have shown that about 8% of males and only 0.5% of females have a color perception deficit, what most people call colorblind. I know you're thinking that you knew males were defective. Well, I guess 8% are. The gene for colorblindness is carried by the female and passed on to the male, so now we know who to blame. So typically a male with colorblindness has a colorblind maternal grandfather. So If a male is colorblind, we know it was his mother's father that actually was also colorblind. As we mentioned, cones are responsible for color perception and work best under moderate to bright light. Cones are in large number in the macula. In fact, the center of the macula, the fovea centralis, is made up entirely of cones and no rods at all. Now you can understand that when macular degeneration is present, you may begin to experience difficulty with color perception. Increasing the ambient lighting may help as you are stimulating more cones that may be remaining outside of the area affected by macular degeneration. Here is a diagram of in the mid part of the retina, not in the very back part of the eye, but kind of midway up through the eye, the distribution of rods and cones. The rods are indicated there by the little dark gray spots, and the cones are scattered around. And there are different cones for the different colors, for reds and greens. But this is a diagram of some information, a researcher from Harvard, Robert Massoff, who's done a lot of work on the distribution of rods and cones. Macular degeneration affects the cones, rods, and the special cells that support the cones and rods, called the RPE cells. The RPE cells are responsible for providing nourishment to the cones and rods, taking away their waste products, and physically holding them in the proper place. Now we understand why macular degeneration causes us to have difficulty seeing details, as it causes a loss first mostly of cones, remember, bright, light, detail vision, and then rods, dim, peripheral vision. How could we keep remaining cones and rods? How about providing them with a good blood supply and good nutrition and less toxins? That means exercise, eating our green leafy vegetables, and not smoking, among other things you can do that we've heard here at the International MD Support Group. Here's a diagram of the macula, and on the left, upper left, you'll see a normal appearing macula, and you'll notice that there's this kind of orangish sheen, and towards the center of the photograph where it says macular, shows where the macula is at the end of that arrow, you'll see a little darker area there. That darker orangey area is actually a area with a lot of lutein and zeaxanthin and some pigment from the RPE cells. And over to the right, you'll see an area of lost retina. That light area right in the center is area of missing retina. That's macular degeneration. The optic nerve is the bundle cable, the transmission line that carries information gathered by the retina to the brain. Amazingly complex, yet simply elegant in its ability to carry huge amounts of information to the brain and remain very small. It has 1.2 million fibers that carry the image information from the retina to the brain. And it's been said that when we transplant a human eye, then we will be able to transplant a whole human brain. And this is actually a cross-section through the brain of an MRI photograph or image. And you'll actually, if you look very carefully with the red arrows that I show there, you'll actually see the optic nerves as they leave from the back of the eye and travel into and going to the back of the brain or into the brain. Now, if we take another view of that and look in a different way and a little clearer, you'll see how the eyes have the optic nerves coming off the back. The eyes are over to the left, and from the back of the eyes, the optic nerves come together. And from the time and the point they come together, from there back to the right is the optic tract, and that eventually goes into the very back part of the brain called the visual cortex, and you'll see that listed there on the back. Now, if we really look at how information is organized in the brain, here's another diagram. Let's look at this a little closer, and let me help you make sense of it. If you're looking from the perspective of the back of the brain, which is down below, to the front of the brain in the eyes, which is up towards the middle there, what is seen, say, for instance, we have a pattern, a green, blue, red, and yellow pattern straight ahead of us, and we're actually looking at that pattern. If you were actually to see where those colors fall into the retinas, that's what you see in those two round globes. You'll see the same colors, but you'll see that they're opposite, actually upside down. The images in the eyes actually are transferred back into the brain, and when they actually land and come back into the visual cortex, which is down in the bottom part of the diagram, you'll notice that all the orange and yellow colors are on the left side, and all the blue and green colors are on the right side. That's actually how your brain segregates its information and images. So everything on the right side of what you see from midline to the right actually is processed by the left side of your brain, and everything you see on the left side of what you look at is processed by the right side of your brain. Amazing, just an amazing thing. The optic tract segregates and organizes the incoming information to the proper parts of the brain. This is done so that the image that projects into the eye upside down can be perceived correct side up in 3D in full color with only a few milliseconds lag in almost real time. Now, where does all this information go? Well, I'm glad you asked. The information is spread through most of the brain. If what you're looking at is smooth or rough or sharp or dull, there are cells in your brain that their sole purpose is to tell if something is hot or cold when you look at it, or metallic. There are cells to tell you what an object is, and there are others to tell you where it is relative to you and where it is relative to other objects around it. There are cells that are dedicated to telling you if what you're looking at relates to something you've seen before. There are cells dedicated to detail, and some to an overall mental picture of where you are at any specific time. It is these cells that can determine if you are a detailed person or prefer to look at the overall of life. In fact, I was just research that there are actually cells in our brain that, if they're more dominant, they will make us be a very, very detailed person. Now, can you think of any personalities like that? Maybe an engineer or a draftsman? And there are cells, if they're more dominant, will make us be more what I call a global person, a person that just wants to see the big picture and really doesn't want to have anything to do with details. Have you ever met an engineer? Very meticulous and detailed. Well, these people have active detail cells, and there are others with overall picture cells. They can't stand the details. Just show them the overall picture. Well, people have made their lifetime careers just studying parts of what we've talked about today. We've barely, and I can't even say barely, scratched the surface. We haven't scratched the surface. But let us all, in the meantime, appreciate each other as a miracle that we are and a gift to each other. Let us bring some joy to each other in some way each day. And I do want to thank each and every person who was here today. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to bring a little bit of things that just bring joy to my life and make me want to get out of bed in the morning and show to others. And I want to turn this over to a question and answer period. And I do thank everyone. If you have any questions, certainly send them in and write them, and we'll be glad to be able to go over each and every one today. And Dan, thank you again for the opportunity. It's just, as always, a wonderful opportunity to do something like this.
Wonderful presentation today. We greatly appreciate that. There's a lot of information packed in there. You didn't mention the telomerase, or the what they call the telomeres, I believe. Is that what they're called? In the cell, which telomeres, that's what they're called, those little shoelace tips on the ends of our chromosomes that researchers have recently discovered are responsible for cell aging. And I wondered if you could get into, I don't want to necessarily talk about the physical aspect of them, but what can we do to protect those and preserve those? Because once those telomeres have been used up on the chromosomes, from what I understand, the cells will not be as effective, the DNA will not be as effective, and that's why we age. Can you review for us the things we can do to keep that from happening, or to prolong that, put off that aging process, the things we can eat, our behaviors, and that kind of thing? Can you kind of review that for us, Ed? Thank you.
Certainly, Dan. Great question. Yeah, it's very fascinating. In fact, I actually was studying this in my undergrad work at the University of South Florida in Tampa back in 1979. Is actually when we started to understand about the telomeres. And that is, if people can think of the there's a part of the DNA strand that will be red to help make proteins. In fact, you know, we're made of many different types of proteins. But each time the actual strand of DNA that will make a protein is actually red, a little piece called a telomere is clipped off the end. In fact, there are many parts of the body that have specific length telomeres, and each time that this little DNA is replicated, a piece is clipped off, and that protein is not replicated anymore. So really, in general, two things that we can say about that is, one, stress relates to that. The more stress that our body is under, and I'm not just talking about mental stress, I'm talking about physical stress too, from oxidation, and that's why we take antioxidants, is to try and prevent that and reduce the effects of oxidative stress. Or also stress from our metabolism. The more the faster our metabolism is, the more cells tend to replicate. If there are cells that are damaged due to oxidative stress or some other type of stress, they have to replicate more to replace them. So if we could do something to reduce the amount of replication that a cell has to go under, the longer these cells will be able to replicate certain proteins. So there's been work done on reduced fat. We're finding out that especially in Western diets, many Western diets have an intake of many more calories than what we typically should. We reduce the calories, which will, in the end, reduce our metabolic rate and also prolong some of the cell lives and clipping off those telomeres so quickly. So that's one of the main things we can do. Also, the antioxidants, the fish oil and the vitamin E and A and some of the other things, the green leafy vegetables. And that's why smoking can be so detrimental, is because smoking obviously causes a tremendous amount of oxidative and toxic stress to our bodies. Different toxins, arsenics and cyanide and many other types of compounds that come along with smoking. So those are the main things I'd like to say about that. Our eyes and retina, we know that the retina is the most metabolically active tissue in the body. It surpasses by far any other tissue, ounce for ounce, for its metabolic rate, even surpassing any part of the brain, any part of the heart, or anywhere. So you can imagine a huge amount of heat is taken in when you're walking around, looking outdoors. That light energy goes into the eye and has to be dissipated. There's a huge amount of chemicals being changed and hit by light, changed, and then have to be regenerated. And then signals are being constantly generated and flooding back into the optic nerve and to the brain. So there's a huge amount of metabolic activity going into the retina. And that's why the eyes, so many different things, like high blood pressure. The eyes can be damaged by that. It can be damaged by smoking, by not eating properly, not getting the right antioxidants in your diet. So I know we've talked a lot about so many different fun facts today, and certainly there's a lot else that could be said, but the eye is just an amazingly wondrous organ, extremely complex. You know, we really even can't look at the eye by itself. You have to look at the brain and how it communicates with the eye, and the eye communicates with the brain and the rest of the body. And that's why I think it's been said for thousands of years, the eyes are the window to the soul or to the body. And that's why so many different diseases like diabetes and blood pressure problems and lupus and HIV and many, many hundreds of other diseases can be first diagnosed in the eye. So we're not just being prejudiced towards eye exams when we do recommend eye exams on a periodic basis, whether it's once a year, or once every other year, or even if it's every month, whatever's needed, and your eye doctor can tell you that, there's certainly a good reason for that.
Thank you. We are going to go ahead and end the session here. I mean, you and I could go on and talk forever, and we probably will next time we get together. We tend to do that. So we're going to end the session a few minutes early, and that might give the groups a chance to discuss what they've heard today and maybe review some of the details, look over the newsletter, have a little social time. We always recommend that. We do want to mention that we're sponsored by LowVision.com and the Macular Degeneration Foundation. We again encourage you to come back next month to listen to Ellen Troyer doing a presentation on holiday food, fun, and eye health. Thank you again, Dr. Huggett, for coming in. We hope everybody enjoyed the presentation, and we'll see you when it gets close to Christmas time in December. Bye for now.